We're going to be in Mark chapter 9 tonight, Mark chapter 9, 30 through 37. And while you're turning over to our text, again, Mark chapter 9, 30 through 37, I want to share with you the crazy fun holiday of the day. I don't know if you can maybe make a guess what that might be. It's mail order catalog day. So go home and pull out your ancient Sears and Roebuck catalogs or your Montgomery Wards. It actually was started by Montgomery Ward in 1872. And then Sears got in on the game in 1893. And I remember Dad talking about my grandma would often call those her wish books. And while they don't exist anymore today, well, not in the form that they did back in the 1800s, Amazon has its own wish list. So that's kind of my wish book. I think my wish list is public if anybody wants to go on there and find me and send me a gift. Anyway, bad joke. But you know what Montgomery Wards and Sears all have in common? They had problems over the decades, didn't they? They all declined greatly. And you know, some people would say that Walmart or Amazon was the problem, but really Walmart was the one that really started the demise of these businesses long ago. Montgomery Wards, my understanding is, they began declining in the 1950s. And they had that big boom. They started back there in the 1800s, the big boom, and in the 50s, they started going down. And so we can't blame completely Amazon. I was just reading some articles in regards to Sears. What it really came down to was just making some bad business decisions through the years. In the 90s, I believe it was the 90s, maybe it was 2000s, a guy by the name of Eddie Lampert took over Sears Holding, and he was a private investor. And rather than him putting money back into the stores, the physical stores, he was cutting. And so I was reading stories about how, you know, lights were burning out, ceilings were leaking, roofs were leaking. He just was not reinvesting any money in that. So Amazon, you know, some people want to blame Amazon, but those stores were just not keeping up with the times. And Amazon just kind of crept in and, well, they've taken over the world. I don't know any, and maybe not literally the world, but they've taken a lot of those customers. But you know, everybody has problems. You know, those declining stores had problems. Everybody has problems. The 12 disciples, they had problems. Last week we were looking a little bit to one of the problems last Sunday evening in Mark chapter 9, verses 14 through 29. And if you were here last Sunday evening, you probably remember us studying through there. And the problem with the disciples was, well, they were trying to do a good thing by casting out that evil demon and that boy, but they were doing it without God. And they failed, and they wanted to know why they failed. And Jesus explained to them why. Now, this week, we're going to continue looking at some more problems that the disciples had. We're going to actually look at two different sections, and we're going to talk about them for a few minutes. So if you have your Bibles open, Mark chapter 9, let's read together, starting in verse number 30, and then we're going to go down through verse number 37. So let's read. Then they departed from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know it. For he, Jesus, taught his disciples and said to them, "The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and after he is killed, he will rise the third day." But they did not understand this saying and were afraid to ask him. Then he came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What was it you disputed among yourselves on the road?" But they kept silent, for on the road they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest. And he sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." Then he took a little child, set him in the midst of them, and when he had taken him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one of these little children in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." So the first problem that we're going to talk about this evening for a few minutes is they weren't growing. They weren't growing spiritually in verses 30 through 32. You see, this is the second time that Jesus had predicted his death to them. The first time, we read in Mark chapter 8, 31 through 33. Jesus there shared with his disciples that he was going to suffer many things, that he was going to be rejected by the religious leaders. Ultimately, he was going to be killed, and then after 3 days, he was going to rise again. And you remember, after Jesus said that to the disciples, one of them pulled Jesus aside and started rebuking Jesus. And Mark tells us it was Peter. Peter rebuked Jesus, and then Jesus turned around and rebuked Peter. So he had a lot of rebuking going on. But Peter, unbeknownst to him at the time, was actually working on behalf of Satan. We talked at some length in regards to that, that Satan would have done anything to have kept Jesus from going to the cross. And so, yes, Peter was rebuked by Jesus. Remember, Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan." And every time that Jesus taught about his death and his resurrection, he did it privately to the 12. And so this would have been part of Jesus' intensive training and him preparing them for what was coming and for his end, at least his end here on earth. And he was traveling while they were teaching. And so it seems that they would have avoided some cities and different towns because he wanted to be alone with them. So they're out there in the countryside, and they're walking, and they're talking, and he's teaching and continuing to teach. And I said this section is really not them, it was about them not growing, but if you think about it, they had grown. But maybe they just hadn't grown spiritually to where Jesus wanted them to be, or maybe where he thought they should have been. And so they were continuing to struggle with that. But I don't know if you caught this or not as we were reading through this text. This time when he predicts his death, it's a little bit different than before. He added a little bit of a new information of what was going to happen this time. This time he added and he revealed to them that he was going to be betrayed into the hands of men and then killed. Prior to this, he didn't say that. So Jesus was hinting at Judas betraying him. Now, I don't know if Judas was already thinking about it or what was going on in Judas's mind, but Jesus knew. Jesus knew exactly what was going on. Jesus, God in the flesh, knew what was happening. He knew he was going to be betrayed. He knew ultimately he was going to go to the cross. And you know what? He freely let it happen. So people cannot sit back and say today, Jesus failed. Jesus failed at the cross. And there are people out there in the religious world that say that. Well, Jesus said in John chapter 10, "Therefore my Father loves me because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down and I have power to take it again. This command I have received from my Father," John 10, 17 through 18. Jesus freely gave up his life. And he knew exactly what was going on. And so Jesus did not fail. It was all part of God's plan. But the problem with the disciples is they didn't understand what Jesus was talking about. You see, they're still thinking in terms of looking forward to this king that was going to conquer Rome, that was going to deliver the Jews, and they struggled with how is our deliverer going to die? And so that just did not make sense to them. What kind of king is that? Now, Mark doesn't tell us this, but Matthew in his account says in Matthew 17, verse 23, that the disciples were sorrowful because of the things that Jesus said. Now, there are people out there that know the Greek language, the original language that the New Testament was written in, and they are far smarter than I. And as I was reading through some of the commentaries and discussion on this particular text, one gentleman said that the tenses of the verbs that are used here in Mark 9, verse 32 shows a continuous state of ignorance and fear on the part of the disciples. They were afraid to ask Jesus what he meant by that. Why were they afraid? Well, you remember the last time somebody questioned Jesus about his death, what Jesus said? "Get behind me, Satan." So I'm pretty sure that was fresh in their mind. They didn't want to hear Jesus calling them out again and scolding them. And I'm going to venture a guess here. If either you or someone close to you, a friend of yours, was ever called Satan, I think you'd probably remember that. And you'd remember who called them that, and you'd probably be a little bit apprehensive of that situation ever arising again. And so fresh in their mind, and so they were very concerned, and they were afraid of even asking Jesus what he meant by that. And you know, and today we may read through this, and we may think to ourselves, well, how could they not understand? I mean, Jesus was pretty blunt, wasn't he? I mean, before he talked to them in stories, and to the other people he'd talk in stories, and the parables, and I'm not going to say talked in mysterious ways, but he talked where things were a little bit hidden, and people would have to dig deeper for the hidden meaning there. Well, now Jesus was pretty blunt. He told them like it was. But we have an advantage today, don't we? We have an advantage that they didn't have. We can look back over the course of time and see exactly what Jesus was saying and how it all played out. They didn't, right? This was as it was going. And another thing that they struggled with is that their concepts and the disciples' concepts and their beliefs about the Messiah was very different. Because as they were children and growing up and learning from their parents, they were looking for that king to deliver them from Rome and that Roman oppression. So they were looking for that earthly king. And that's the same type of problem that the Jewish people are dealing with today. They're looking for a physical king, a physical Messiah. And for that matter, when Jesus was talking about dying and coming back to life and to never die again, to them that would have been a strange concept. That had never happened before. And so of course they were struggling with it. And of course they were not being able to fully comprehend and understand what Jesus was saying. And here's the crux of the matter. They didn't understand, and they didn't want to know. And they were afraid to ask. And maybe in the back of their minds, maybe they were thinking ignorance is bliss. I'm sure they didn't have that statement a couple thousand years ago, but maybe the Jewish people had something along the lines of that. Maybe they were just thinking, well, we're better off not knowing. We'll just let Jesus continue to say what he's saying, and I won't be called Satan. So we're just going to let him go on that. But this really leads us to the root of the problem, which the next problem that we read there in verses 33 to the end of our text in verse 37 is that they were focusing on physical things, weren't they? They were focusing on the physical. Again, Mark tells us that they'd passed through the area of Galilee, they got into Capernaum, and they get to the house. Whose house? I mean, I haven't a clue. Some people think, well, maybe Jesus' relatives had a home there. It could have been. Capernaum seemed to be a place that was kind of his home base. Other disciples had lived in the area. Whose house? I don't know, but he was in a house. And I know that there was a child there from what we read. But along the way, as they were out there on the road traveling back to this house, there was an argument which popped up amongst the disciples. And they argued and debated amongst themselves who would be the greatest. Now, what possibly would have caused that argument? Because they were still thinking of a king who's going to take over Rome. And now our king's going to be dead. And so who's going to be the great one to take over for our king? And so they were concerned about power and might and personal ambition. This human ambition was rearing its ugly head. There's nothing wrong with being ambitious, right? We want to do the best that we can. We want to make improvements in our life. But this kind of ambition was just misfocused. It was misplaced. It was the wrong kind of ambition. Consider this. Jesus was out there on the road teaching them about him dying. They were out there on the road fighting about who was going to take over for Jesus. Talk about worlds apart in the mindsets there. So this text shows us why human ambition is bad, and when it rears its ugly head, what it can cause. First of all, we see from the disciples' example that this human ambition can cause arguments. It can cause fighting amongst the people, can't it? They were divisive, they were arguing, they were bickering back and forth, as well as reasoning. And so there's this tension and there's this debate on the road amongst themselves, going back and forth, fighting. 12 men. I can just imagine they all didn't walk at the same pace. So I'm sure you had some in the back who were debating, and then somebody was quicker and run to the front and go, hey, this person said that. And then they're kind of bouncing back and forth all over the place, fighting with one another, posturing for position. It sounds a little political, doesn't it? And number two, this type of ambition can create shame. You see in verse number 34, when Jesus called them out on it, what did they do? They kept quiet. It was embarrassing to them, wasn't it? Embarrassing that they would fight over power and fame and position. You know, maybe some of those men were jealous over Peter, James, and John. Why did those three get to go to the mountaintop? What happened up there? Why won't you tell us? Why are you keeping secrets from us? So arguing and shame. And we see what needs to happen when human ambition rears its ugly head in our text from Jesus and Jesus teaching them. We see, number one, it needs correction, doesn't it? It needs correction. Jesus sat down, and Mark tells us that he called the 12 to him. Jesus took the position of a teacher, and they knew what they were about to receive was a profound lesson. And number two, this type of ambition needs to be redirected toward the right goal. Is there anything wrong, really, with wanting to be great and do a great job? I don't believe so. It depends on what the motive is. If you want the praise and the accolation and the power, that would be wrong. But I believe this. I think everybody wants to be great. That's kind of what some of our politicians have ran on this last time, right? Trying to make America great again is what he says. But Jesus tells us exactly what we need to do to be great. And really, that conflicts with what the world's view of greatness is, isn't it? He says, if you want to be great, this is what you need to do. Be last of all. Wow, that seems the opposite. I thought if you wanted to be great, you need to be number one. You need to be first place. That's not what Jesus said. And Jesus says, be servant of all. It's good to be a servant. We need to be serving and helping others. Do you remember back in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, Jesus says, when you do serve others, when you do help others, don't do it again for that pat on the back. Don't be looking for the praise of men. You know, you do it so that your Father in heaven can be glorified. And so then Jesus takes this opportunity to teach what it means by being a good servant, by being great, and he grabs hold of a small child. I wonder if that kid was scared. What are you doing to me? Right? Preachers preach a sermon, and then they call out their youngest, like Chloe. I'm just kidding, Chloe. And then they call out their children, and then they're embarrassed. Oh, I wonder what that child was thinking. Oh, boy. So Jesus grabs a small child. He puts him there in the midst of them, and he teaches an important lesson. And he teaches us, and he taught them, the disciples. And don't forget this. These were rugged men, right? Most of them were fishermen. Men who are not afraid of storms, bad, although some of the storms terrified them, but they'd seen some rough things in their life. Tax collectors who'd been shunned by their entire community. And he takes a small child and teaches some important lessons. And so consider some qualities to teaching and working with children. Addison, I hope you're taking notes. To work with children, it's going to require a special demeanor. And it's going to require a special type of person and a spirit within them. To work with kids, you need to have love. You need to care for them. You need to be forgiving of them because they're going to make mistakes, aren't they? And you need to trust them, and you need to give them some of that rope to be able to learn and grow. It takes some humility as well to work with children. And something I got to remind myself of, you know, with our kids, and is that children don't know everything yet. And I think sometimes us older people, we just expect the little people to know everything right away. But they're still learning, and they're still growing. So it takes a special person with a special spirit and demeanor about themselves to work with kids. But it also takes courage. Plug your ears, little one. It can be scary dealing with little kids, right? Sometimes. So it takes courage to be. And you got these brutally men, these manly men, and you're like, oh. Courage to be able to work with a child, because it's a big responsibility. Huge responsibility to teach those children, because they're the next generation. It's going to require faith. Believing that child is learning and that they're going to respond accordingly to the teaching and the instruction that you're giving them. Which reminds me that dealing with children requires a great deal of patience and perseverance. Because sometimes as you're teaching and giving those instruction to the little people, sometimes you wonder if they're tuned in to actually what you're saying, but they're listening. It just might take them time to respond to the things that we're instructing them. And Jesus was essentially teaching them and us today that children have special needs that need to be met. But in reality, we all do. We're all children. We're all God's children. And Jesus concludes this lesson with a wonderful promise to them. He says, "Whoever receives one of these little children in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." And it's very similar to the picture that we're given in Matthew chapter 25, verse 34 and following, where Jesus gives us a glimpse at what the day of judgment is going to be like. If you remember that particular chapter, Jesus talked about in that day that the goats are going to be separated from the sheep, and those that are going to enter into heaven are going to be, you know, the righteous ones. They will be the ones that have fed the hungry, those that have helped the thirsty, those that have helped those who are sick, and it will be those that have gone to visit those who are in prison. And you remember what Jesus said there in Matthew 25? When you've gone out and you've helped those folks, in essence, you have really helped him. So today, if we're not careful, we can have the same problems, can't we, that the disciples had. Actually, you know, looking at the text right before this, the disciples with their problem of trying to do something right, but they failed because they didn't include God in their plans. That's a reminder to us today. And then in Mark 9, verse 30 through 37, we need to remember that we need to grow. We shouldn't be afraid to ask questions. We need to dig deeper into the Bible. But we also need to be less focused on physical things and not worry about human ambition and who's going to be the greatest and who's number one. We can work together and we can serve and help and love one another and love the children, right? Love the children. Tonight, if you're not a child of God, we'd like to extend the invitation to you at this time. Reminded of the words of Paul and his writing to 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, when he said that God is going to take vengeance on those that do not know God and those that do not obey the gospel. Paul said he went everywhere preaching and teaching the gospel. That is the good news of the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 1 through 4. tonight, if you've not obeyed the gospel, you can do so this evening. You obey it by following the example of Jesus, Romans chapter 6, 1 through 4. You put to death that old person of sin. You bury that person in the waters of baptism, where we contact the saving blood of Christ. We have our sins washed away. Acts 22, verse 16. You come up out of that water a new creation. If you've not done that tonight and you're ready to do so, we're here to help assist you. Or perhaps you're struggling with something, you desire the prayers of the church. We're here to help you in any way that we can. If you have a need, you'd like to make it known at this time, you can do so as together we stand and as we're led in the invitation song.